Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Folklore. I'm Rachel Hopkin, one of the hosts of the channel, and today's guest is Claire Schmidt, who's here to talk about her first book. It's called If You Don't Laugh, You'll Cry, The Occupational Humor of White Wisconsin Prison Workers. Claire Schmidt, welcome to New Books in Folklore.
Thank you for having me.
So, some of the interpretations of the word folklore in wide usage don't necessarily correlate with how the term is understood within the discipline of folklore studies. So I guess I wanted to start by asking you what you understand by that word folklore and how the occupational humor of prison workers qualifies as folklore.
Sure. For me, Dan Benamosa's definition of folklore, folklore is artistic communication in small groups. And that definition is expansive. And so it embraces a lot of kinds of knowledge and practices and oral traditions that, you know, fall within the purview of folklore. So if we think of it as, you know, non-institutionally taught knowledge or ways of saying things, ways of doing things, ways of understanding oneself and the world around one, then this is very much folklore. And so folklorists have been interested in occupations and sort of the knowledge and the tools and the specialized communication that goes along with different professions. So historically, folklorists have been really interested in super manly stuff. So lumberjacking or fishing or working in steel mills, things that are really, really full of men. And then over, you know, the last 20 or 30 years, occupational folklorists have sort of expanded that understanding that, you know, work and the lore of work applies to upper class professions, just as much as it does to very blue collar working class professions. And so because I come from, you know, a lower middle class background, and I'm really interested in the kinds of occupations that I grew up around, I wanted to write about the traditional jokes, the traditional pranks, the traditional genres of stories that are told about the job and around the job, and the ways that that people teach the job and speak the job, as Tim Tangerlini has said in his work with paramedics. How we talk about what we do is very revealing when you want to understand an occupation.
That's grand. So we're going to hear more about this in a moment. But before we get to the book itself, I wondered if you could tell me how you came to be a folklorist and perhaps not a prison worker, because I understand that's very much part of your family background.
Yeah. I think probably lots of folklorists would say this, but I think if you ask family members, they would say, oh, yeah, like always, duh, this person was going to become a folklorist because it was, you know, the kids sitting around listening to the adults talk and taking notes about, oh, I've never heard that story before. And this word and this practice and sort of the, maybe a compulsive desire to document, to understand, to save information, and to recognize patterns in speech, recognize patterns in behavior, but also to appreciate the artistic investment that people make when they play practical jokes on each other or when they tell ridiculous stories at the Thanksgiving dinner table. So I have always been interested in nearly every aspect of folklore and read very much as a kid. When I was growing up in Wisconsin, we listened to Down Home Dairyland, which was a radio program put out by Jim Leary and Richard Marsh. And so it played Wisconsin folk music. My parents, my grandparents, even my grandparents, my great-grandparents were very interested in folk music and traditional music. So, you know, I was raised on Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie and Arlo Guthrie and the Staples family. And so I was surrounded by an appreciation for folklore, and I grew up reading folk tales and fairy tales. So it was everywhere. But I didn't seriously consider it. And for a long time, I worked as an environmental activist and in Madison. And as I was finishing an undergraduate degree in English, I stumbled into a class on ballads taught by Jack Niles, who was at the University of Wisconsin and had just joined it around the same time I had. And this class blew my mind wide open, and it was easily the most influential class I've ever taken. I learned so much on this ballad class, and he had Jim Leary, a really, really important Wisconsin folklorist and you know, long time contributor to the field. And Jim gave a guest lecture, and then I realized, oh, this is the guy with the radio show. This is the guy who all these songs, and he played, you know, Wisconsin ballads. And I'm not sure what generation. My family has been in Wisconsin for a really long time. So it was the really powerful experience of seeing yourself replicated that I think, you know, white people like me, we get to see this a lot, but it's still really meaningful when it happens. And so when you recognize your own folklore and your own self, and then you realize that it has a value, that is exciting. And then Jim said, well, you could go to grad school. And so after a while I did. And I enjoy my work so much. And I was able to work with John Foley, who's an oral tradition scholar, and Elaine Lawless, who's, of course, well known for her work with reciprocal ethnography, ethical ethnography, feminist folklore, women's folklore, and Anand Prahlad, who, you know, is very well known for his post-colonial approaches to folklore, but also, you know, both are quite invested in creative ethnography as well. So I was lucky to work with lots of great people and who've supported me in my work.
So this was at the University of Missouri, and you're now based in Missouri at a different educational institution. So this has been very Missouri-based kind of period of study and work. But your book is set in, it's all based in Wisconsin. So can you tell us a little bit about how the book came about?
Sure. When I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, Jim Leary said, hey, do you want a job? I got a part-time job for you. And I said, sure, because I really like working and I'm really interested in work and I will never turn down work. And so he said, you can work on this Wisconsin Weather Stories project. We need a folklorist. Well, I've taken exactly two folklore courses, but yes, I'm definitely interested. But in order to have this job, which was really exciting and really fun, working on the Wisconsin Weather Stories project, which won some awards with American Folklore Society, with Ann Pryor and Jim Lear and others. I had to re-enroll as a student. I'd just graduated. So I took a class in American folklore and we needed to do an ethnography. So I interviewed my grandfathers who both worked in prisons and worked up this very basic, you know, ethnographic portrait of this occupation. And then I came back to it during my master's work and thought a lot more about the humor and realized that what I am really, really interested in is humor. And then thought about it some more during my PhD work. And then it became part of a dissertation that was a comparative ethnography of the occupational humor of social workers and prison workers, because my family is full of both. And so sort of once I had defended my dissertation and took a little bit of a breathing space. I was lucky enough to be accepted into a first book workshop that was funded by the Mellon Foundation and organized through the University of Illinois Press, the University of Wisconsin Press, and the University of Mississippi Press. So I was able to, you know, be in a workshop with amazing peers, amazing mentors, who really helped us understand the process of writing and revising and presenting an academic book, a sustained argument. So it's done now, and I have many people to thank for it.
Well, there's a section of acknowledgements in the book, which people can turn to for those thank yous. We won't cover them all here. But I'm just curious, just briefly, before we go on to the book itself, can you tell me a little bit about that process of changing a dissertation into a published book? I mean, was there lots of revision to do? And what was the nature of that revision in a nutshell?
Huge revision. I rewrote nearly every word and sometimes several times. But it was great. I learned so much about writing. I learned so much about making an argument. You know, Ruth Olson, who's on, who's with the Center for Studies, in, Center for CSUMC, Studies in Upper Midwestern Cultures, was a big mentor through the process. And so, you know, what the book became was maybe a third of the dissertation, but I tore everything down structurally and in general and just rewrote the whole thing a couple of times.
Wow, good for you. Okay. So the book's wonderfully readable and full of lots of humorous stories, although it's not all humor by any manner of means. So I just wonder if you could start taking us through. You start with an introduction, which is very much setting out a context, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about that context?
Well, Wisconsin as a state has a lot of prisons. And as Wisconsinites, lots of us work or are fed because of prisons. And so I am really interested in the relationship between race and power and incarceration. And so we know in Wisconsin, which is a state that has historically seen itself as progressive, like we claim the birthplace of the Progressive Party in Wisconsin, it is not a friendly place for people of color. And so African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans, and Native Americans are incarcerated at rates far, far higher than the national average. And so this social injustice of that maybe begins with profiling and is continued in sentencing plays out very, very clearly in the sentences that are lived out by inmates, both male and female, in Wisconsin. And at the same time, working at prisons is very taxing. It is tremendously stressful. It's part of the criminal justice field, but prison workers do not get heroic status like police officers might, and it's very difficult to explain what you do and why you do it to outsiders. So I think it's a very isolating field as well. On the other hand, I think that people who work in prisons have a great deal of insight into issues of race and class and criminal justice and mental illness. And certainly not all prison guards are good or bad people. They're just people like all people. But I think understanding your role in upholding an unjust system, I think can be very emotionally and spiritually taxing for people who work in prison.
So this is an ethnographic work to a certain extent. You obviously, I think I'm right in understanding you didn't actually go inside prisons. Is that right?
That's right. I decided early on in the project that I was not going to go into prisons. Instead, I wanted to study the verbal art. And a lot of this is very focused on stories, narrative, and some of the material culture and some of the ephemeral material culture that lives on the internet to a lesser extent through the ways that the job comes home rather than trying to go into the prison. That's not my place. I would be obstructive and it would put my collaborators in significant danger, I think, from political reprisal or other consequences. So taking a lot of care to make sure that the people who shared their experiences with me did not suffer negative consequences was really important.
So in terms of the people that you did interview and focus on in the book, how did you go about finding them and selecting them and so on and so forth?
It's a great question. When I started the project, I interviewed every person who worked in a prison who would stand still long enough for me to talk with them. And so I did lots and lots and lots of interviews with people I didn't know or with people who, you know, were friends of friends of friends or people I would run into in the grocery store or people who would see what I was reading on the bus. And so I talked to as many prison workers as I could. In terms of what I used in the book, I decided that I wanted to focus on the experiences of people that were known to me, that I was part of their life. They were part of my life, so that then I would be able to share the manuscript with them at various stages so that they would feel comfortable enough saying, no, you have this wrong here, or I think you've misunderstood this, or have you, what I really think is happening is this other thing, so that I would be able to find them always, so that I would know where they live, so that I can give them a copy of the book and then say, okay, can we talk about this? So multiple interviews was really important, and being able to work with people who were, let's say, that I owed something to make sure that I was ethical and careful. And it's a lot easier to be unethical when you're writing about people you don't know, that you're not going to see again. So it was an ethical choice.
So these are people who were known to you because of your family connections to people working in the prison service.
That's right. Both of my grandfathers worked in prisons for their entire career. One as an officer, or what you would think a guard, and one as a social worker who specialized in working with violent sex offenders. And they carpool to work sometimes together. Then I have an uncle who worked as a correctional officer, and then worked as a parole agent and held various positions. My ersatz godmother worked as a guard until she retired just a few years ago. My ersatz other godmother and godfather both had worked in prisons, and one of their sons worked as a correctional officer. So when my family gets together, or when there's a big group camping trip where lots and lots of friends of families where people all get together, prison is constantly present. The Department of Corrections is like the third person sitting at the table, constantly a part of, can you pay your mortgage? How about that health insurance? You know, I'm sorry you couldn't have that day off. So prison is a big part of it.
Yes. And in fact, you cover this kind of boundary between life as a working with inside the prison and negotiating how one remains a prison worker, but in a family situation outside later on in the book. But we'll come to that in a little bit, because I want to start we'll go through the book in stages, and it's divided into three sections, three parts. So tell me, what is part one about?
Part one is the background information, largely. So how many prisons does Wisconsin have, and who works there, and how do they shape the communities in which the prisons are sited? And how do employees interact with inmates, because this book isn't about the experiences of incarcerated people. It's not my story. It's an important story that needs to be told, but I'm not the person who can do that story justice. People who live in prisons are there. That is what makes up a prison. And so the relationships between people who work in prison and people who are doing time in prison shapes the job. And the first part of the book sort of outlines the kinds of expressive culture, and specifically the expressive culture that is intended to be funny as a person transitions to work and back to the home.
I was quite shocked when you're kind of like laying out some of the background information to learn that average lifespan for a prison worker after leaving on retirement is 1.5 years. So what makes the job so difficult and so stressful and so hard on the people who work in the profession?
I think that it's a combination of I think some of it is physical and a lot of it is psychological. And so in terms of the physical stress, there's a lot of downtime, a lot of sitting quite often. So for people who work in observation towers, you sit and you stare for a shift, or maybe you get called to work a double, so you sit and stare for two shifts. And so you can walk around and get rounds in, but there's not a lot of opportunity to do sort of healthy moving things. Next, it's shift work. And so shift work, you know, working first shift or second shift or third shift is really noted for its impacts on lifestyle and health, because you might be separated from, you know, sort of the traditional family rhythms. It makes diet more difficult to navigate. It makes sleep very difficult to navigate. And so when you're switching from, I work first shift today, but, you know, tomorrow I got to work second, your body has a hard time adjusting, and that's really difficult. So any shift work is difficult. But then I think a lot of the stress comes from being in a dangerous environment. And so some institutions, you know, minimum security institutions tend to have far fewer violent instances because the people who are there have a lot to lose. They're going to go home really soon. And so they're very invested in making sure that things run smoothly. But working in a maximum security prison can be really difficult, especially men's prisons. And there's always the threat of violence, whether it's violence between inmates or violence directed towards staff. So sometimes people get hurt, and a lot more often there's the threat of being hurt, and there's the need to be constantly vigilant while at the same time not much is happening. And so the combination of impending danger and extreme boredom is very difficult to manage. And then it's very difficult to maintain family relationships, especially in Wisconsin right now. There's a staffing crisis within the Department of Corrections. And so new officers have to work lots and lots and lots of extra time. So that makes it very difficult to pick up your kids from school when you're supposed to, or, you know, conform to a custody agreement if you get ordered to work a double at a certain time. You miss Christmas, you miss Thanksgiving. You don't feel like talking when you get home. So I think all in all, the relationship of sort of difficult physical aspects and difficult emotional and social aspects really contributes to a compromised life expectancy and long-term health outcomes for people who work in prisons.
So the next chapter you've written, chapter two, is titled "Does Prison Make You Racist?" which is quite an interesting title, and I was struck by the fact you are only this is a study of white prison workers. So I guess my question is: Does prison make you a racist, or does working in a prison make you racist?
I think working in prison changes your understanding of race in the United States. I directly asked my collaborators if working in prison made them racist. And their responses were no, but, or yes, but. And so there's not a clear answer to that question. I think that a lot of people who work in prisons, a lot of white people who work in prisons, do not encounter people of color during their everyday life. It's very easy for white people to live in a largely white environment. This has been really thoroughly studied. But people who work in prison, those white people tend to have their first experiences of what it's like to be an ethnic minority, what it's like to be surrounded by people coming from other cultures who speak a different way, who look a different way, who have a different understanding of how the world works. And so my collaborators agreed that if the only people of color you interact with are inmates at a maximum security prison for men, you're going to form certain ideas about Black men or Hispanic men that are informed by that experience that will not be easy to eradicate from one's mind. On the other hand, these are not new ideas. It's not like people who work in prison are divorced in some way from the other understandings of Black masculinity or Hispanic or Latino masculinity. So a lot of the people that I interviewed said, maybe if that's your only experience, then you might be a racist. You might think or say or do racist things. On the other hand, a lot of white people have zero contact with people of color, and so have a very limited understanding of actual living people of color, as opposed to people on television or people whose music they listen to. So in terms of spending a lot of time with not white people, white prison workers certainly have a lot of experiences and insights into that experience of being a person of color in the United States. It's not simple, though, I think, is the answer.
Right, right. And one of the things you cover quite extensively in the book is, or at least you refer to many times, is the fact that the incarceration system operates in such a way that people of color are disproportionately represented in the prison population when compared to the population at large. And this is because of not because of a necessarily higher crime rate amongst these people, but more to do with the way that the policies regarding incarceration and regarding how certain crimes are targeted by law enforcement officials. Am I right in understanding that? And if so, is this something that the correctional officers have a much awareness of?
Definitely. When I talked to my collaborators, they referenced mandatory minimum sentencing a lot. And so certain crimes have a mandatory minimum that then a person is sentenced with. And so, for example, crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. We know that, you know, from very, very clear, very big studies, white people and Black people use crack and sell crack at about the same rate. And yet, overwhelmingly, people serving significant time in prison for crack-related offenses are Black because of who gets stopped and has their car searched, or what neighborhoods are sort of given a pass. I think people who work in prison are super aware of this and have a lot of critique for especially nonviolent drug offenses and a lot of hostility toward policies that have made our prisons overcrowded, unnecessarily overcrowded, have broken families unnecessarily. And so many of the people I interviewed would talk about marijuana and how absurd they found it, that they had to spend their time, in their words, babysitting people because of pot, that it was an enormous waste of taxpayer money and an enormous waste of their own personal time that could have been spent in far more useful ways. So I think no one is a bigger critic of the criminal justice system than people who work in the criminal justice system. But it's also very hard to express those views in a way that is that would not be perceived as hostile toward one's coworkers. And so that's really important too. It's very difficult to be, there's a huge line between insider and outsider. And so we rarely see corrections workers critiquing the corrections system on television because that violates an enormous code of behavior.
Although later in the book, you do come to a section where you're looking at how they are using humor to make digs at the institutions for which they work and the more broader part of the justice system that they form part of. We'll come to that in a little while. I'm curious, did you come across any correctional officers who were people of color?
I've talked to a lot of correctional officers, mostly Black correctional officers, a few Native American and Hispanic correctional officers. And I think that their experiences they share a lot of similarities with the experiences of white correctional officers, but they share a lot of differences as well. And I think there's an enormous expectation for officers of color to empathize, to understand the experiences of inmates, but the line between officer and inmate is not crossable. And so it creates a lot of potential stress. So I think I wouldn't want to extend all of my arguments to officers of color because the racial dynamic is enormously powerful.
Yes, of course. So in the next chapter, which is the last chapter of the first part, it's called Don't Take Your Work Home With You. And it's about negotiating the boundaries between work and home. So, of course, you first got introduced to all of this in the home environment, right? You were being told jokes around Thanksgiving and things like that. Do you remember some of the jokes that stood out for you when you were a kid growing up with these grandfathers who were correctional officers and so on and so forth?
The ones that were really memorable were imitations of inmates or patients who had been at the Wisconsin Central State Hospital for the Criminal Insane. It's an institution that is no longer there. That's not what it's called anymore. But it was a place where people who had profound mental illnesses and had also committed serious crimes were housed. And so, for example, Ed Gein, who is the loose inspiration for The Silence of the Lambs, was there. And he paneled my grandfather's office. And apparently he was an excellent dancer and a really good basketball player and not a bad carpenter either. And so there were these characters who were inmates or patients who had very, very noticeable mannerisms, largely due to their mental illnesses or the medications they were taking. They were very easy to imitate, and the imitations were highly appreciated by people who knew these inmate patients. And this is something that social workers do today, is, make fun of their patients, imitate their mannerisms. Certainly it's hostile. Certainly it is completely inappropriate. And yet it fulfills, I think, a really important need for people who do this kind of job.
And I was struck by some of the things, the humor that you use when you're talking about this issue of negotiating these boundaries. There's something on page 61, 62, and it's comes from 45 signs that you're a correctional officer. And it includes things like this is outside of the prison, but you throw away a full can of soda because it was out of your sight for 30 seconds, for example. The buzzer in a TV basketball game makes you jump, because I presume that relates to a sound that you would hear inside the prison. Before you can buy a woman a drink, you have to make sure she doesn't have an Adam's apple. Those were some of the ones I was noticing. I was curious in terms of this as well, in terms of your research process, because presumably there are humorous stories that you can tell to the whole family. There are humorous stories that a correctional officer can tell to a researcher like you, particularly one who has some insider access. And then insider access in terms of coming from a family that has prison workers. I don't mean insider access to the prison itself. But then there are probably, I would imagine there's humor that cannot be told even to you with your all your connections and so on and so forth. I mean, did you ever kind of cover that tent in the abstract? Did you ever talk about things that they couldn't tell you?
Only a little bit. I tried really hard to not ask the question, what's the worst thing you ever saw? Because I think that's an annoying question. I think it's almost as annoying as, you know, making the don't drop the soap joke. Like it is expected and it's not the point. So I didn't ask for those stories. I would have been glad to hear them, but I think the act of telling them would have been, it would have felt really inappropriate to be telling that story to this person. Mostly I was interviewing people who maybe my parents and my grandparents' generation, a few people from my generation. But I think those stories, largely because of issues of gender, I think, and then issues of, you know, insider, outsider, I didn't ask. We talked a lot about things you don't want to say at home. And I wanted to leave that alone and not push that boundary.
Oh, no, I totally get that. And I wasn't really thinking that you would have asked such questions, because they probably wouldn't be answered anyway. But I just was more curious as to whether you approached the things that you weren't approaching, if that makes sense. But there seems to have been plenty to cover even without going into that. So what did you learn in the course of this kind of this boundary inside the work role, back into home role, that maybe surprised you? Or maybe it would surprise your readers, if not you, since you have so much background in it.
I think for me, the thing that was surprising, but also shouldn't have been surprising, is that outsiders don't know what to say. And so storytellers don't want to tell stories that aren't going to work for an audience. And I think that being verbal and being a really good storyteller is an essential part of being a successful correctional officer. The ability to tell a story and to build a story around you that other people can inhabit for a little while is an enormous skill. And so the ability to judge your audience then is an immense part of that. And so you don't want to tell a story that someone is going to say, oh, you're so sick, or that was awful, how could you do that? Or, so what? So that's the end of the story. Okay. And so I think there's a perception that outsiders aren't interested. Outsiders don't know what to say. They'll feel uncomfortable. And so a need to sort of have a set of narratives that you can pull out when someone says, oh, you work in a prison, that sounds messed up. And have those stories ready. My sister's a social worker, and one of my best friends had done work that is sort of in between social work and prison work. And they both talked about, like, they would have incredibly complicated, interesting, difficult days, and they would come home and someone would say, how was your day? And they'd be like, it's fine. It's totally, because there just weren't words that would be, that could fit into that context. At the same time, when you have a community with a lot of insiders, then you can have those eavesdroppers like me who sit around on the edges and listen to one officer tell another officer a story that they both find hilarious, and I don't know why it's funny. When you have that mass, that critical mass of people within the culture, then what can come home is a much bigger pool.
And actually, this leads on very neatly into part two, because very early in part two, you write something about part of your interest in doing this research was to find out whether your family and your friends in the who do work in these correctional facilities are just unusually funny, or if that's part of the job. So tell us a little bit about what part two is covering.
The second part of the book it really focuses on the ways that humor is doing work, that humor is a part of the work of making a prison function or being a parole agent. And so the ways that humor is used to initiate new members, the ways that humor is used to teach new people traditions or keep people in line, don't get above yourself. The second part of the book really focuses on humor, but also the ways that, you know, no one teaches you in school that you need to be funny. By the way, you need to learn to tell good stories. You need to learn to make people laugh, because if you can't, people are going to make fun of you. So I think the verbal quickness and the ability to have a comeback, to do verbal sparring, that is funny, but has an edge in it, because so many interactions are inherently combative, both in prisons and out of prisons. These are skills that if you get good at work, you bring it home with you. And so I grew up with a lot of adults who are very verbally fast. They could think really quickly and come up with answers and smart remarks, and I could never keep up. And so I just was fascinated by this. But then, you know, the more I taught, the more I worked with students, the more I found myself like needing that kind of repartee, that kind of back chat that is really necessary when you need people to do something you want them to do that they don't really want to do.
Right. And I'm actually curious, in the course of all the people that you interviewed, many of whose contributions may not have ended up in this book, did you find anybody who seemed to be lacking a sense of humor and you had to maybe rule them out of being a potential interviewee for the final work?
That's a good question. There were definitely people who I didn't find funny, that they were throwing me jokes and I was, you know, nodding and smiling, but it just wasn't funny, or it wasn't working for me. And then there were people who had really entertaining, maybe verbal mannerisms. They were good at sort of the flashy talk, but then had a hard time laughing at themselves, or, you know, the humor didn't go deep enough to be, you know, to reflect on the very strange juxtapositions that you get in a job like this. So I think there are many different kinds of humor, and certain kinds really thrive. And the ability to laugh at yourself and the ability to tease in a way that is not undermining is very effective. But I think not every, as my collaborators talked a lot about, like, if you can't learn that, the job of getting people to do stuff they don't want to do is much harder.
Right. And you make it very clear in this book that learning to laugh is a really important part of taking on the role of a correctional officer. Can you tell us some of the kind of, and there's a whole kind of body of jokes that are related to transforming outsiders into insiders, I think, which is the subject of chapter 5, i.e. transforming people who have not worked in the prison service before, into prison workers. So can you tell us a little bit about how that worked?
Yeah, I think that a lot of transformative humor involves making a person look stupid and then learning to deal with the fact that someone just made you look stupid and to be able to up the ante and embrace how stupid you just looked. So, you know, sending people on, you know, fake errands to go find something that doesn't exist. The Cushmaker, there's, I think Alan Dundas has written about this. You know, giving someone a humiliating nickname, painting something on their lunchbox, where you have to embrace hostility in order to embrace friendship. And so I think a lot of learning to laugh is first learning to laugh at an attack on yourself, because that's something that is a constant feature of working in prison, whether it's an attack on the way you look or the way you sound or who you are, or a more subtle attack that is, you know, attempting to get you to do something that you don't want to do. And so building that kind of thick skin where you can catch an attack and up the ante and throw it back in a way that is funny is very helpful.
I didn't mean to cut you off there. So one of the hating jokes that I found funny when I was going through this was it was something to do with a prison guard needing a key from somebody on a watchtower, I think. And he was told that the code to get this was Rosebud. So he was shouting Rosebud up at this, the person in the watchtower for a very long time until the person in the watchtower finally said, "Look, stop yelling Rosebud at me. What are you doing?" Mm-hmm. So that's a fairly straightforward one, because obviously Rosebud was not the key to getting the key. Can you think of a more subtle, an example of a more subtle joke that has to do with getting someone to do something they don't want to do, which is, as you said, it's not an easy thing to do?
That's a really good question. I think quite often a person has to create a situation where for a minute the staff is aligned with the inmate. And so, for example, there's a story that one of my collaborators told me about an inmate who was taking a shower and there were no towels and he wanted a towel. And one guard said no. And the guard who was the person I was interviewing said, like, seriously, we need to be able to find this guy a towel. And then the guard was insisting, no, 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 he'll survive without a towel. And so the person I interviewed, his response was to then fan the inmate dry with his clipboard, like this instrument of authority and power. And so for a second to make him, you know, subservient to this poor guy who just wanted a towel. He makes himself look stupid. He makes the institution look absurd and like, of course you can get a towel. And then of course they did get a towel. So to temporarily create imaginative space where, you know, we're not in opposition for just a second, we can work together, I think can be helpful.
What you're covering now is actually one of my favorite parts of the book. So it's part of, it's chapter 6, Humor and Inmate Staff Relationships. Because so often we hear about correctional officers, or we see them portrayed as these kind of inhumane, malign forces within prisons. This is what you often see in popular culture, and you discuss this and talk about the impact that it has on the prison workers. But here we see some lovely examples of this humor working between the correctional officers and the inmates, or in the way that the correctional officers are talking about the inmates. For example, there was one officer who is relating to you how charmed he was by the great pains a particular prisoner took to make his bed all neat, and then places a chocolate on top of the pillow or something like that. Is that right? And carry on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kind of coping was seen as, you know, he's doing it as a joke. It's hilarious and ridiculous. And for a second, like, everyone gets to print it and like, yeah, prison's great. You come home, there's chocolate on your pillow. Look at that. Isn't that nice? And so, you know, that kind of response, messing with reality in that kind of positive way, I think is perceived by guards as not only helpful because it's a lot better than resisting and violence, but is also just funny. And so to appreciate humor that is also self-deprecating, but at the same time refusing to give in to the despair and the violence and the hatred around you. I think that a lot of prison workers pick up a lot of smart talk and funny talk from the people that they work with. I think they learn a lot about verbal repartee and about being funny from inmates. I think there's an enormous appreciation for the verbal artist in prison, the ways that people are creative and funny. I think it makes staff's job easier, but then I think just fundamentally, as one storyteller to another storyteller, like, that's good work. What you're doing is interesting and funny, and I'm going to steal it because that bit really worked.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. Another one I really liked was where a prisoner who I think was quite well liked, but also got into very difficult emotional situations, was trying to get a prison guard to make a telephone call for him or something. And eventually he just yelled at the guard, just stop resisting, which I think is what the guards always are saying to the prisoners, that to have this turned back on him just was another very funny incident in the middle of quite a stressful situation where somebody is trying to get something done by somebody who doesn't want to do it. So I'm curious, in terms of actually writing the chapters, did you have a favorite one to write?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think no, I like them differently for different things. I have favorite stories. I have ideas that, you know, I think even now I still haven't fully thought out. And so, like, I'm still really interested in that chapter because I think I haven't quite figured out what's going on, but there's something that I want to get at. But yeah, I very much like this chapter because it's nice to think about ways that people use traditional speech and traditional humor techniques to temporarily not kill each other. Like, these are really important techniques in a prison, but also in the everyday world. And so we use humor to create these very temporary but very powerful vacations from all of the terrible things that we experience. And, you know, to be able to think about the kind of power that we have when we can make other people laugh and the ways that we can take stress away from them, even if that stress is, you know, a prank phone call saying, hey, this guy in your caseload, this pedophile is down at the park with candy taped all over him. And then you have to come back and say, oh, no, I'm just messing with you. And then you have this moment of stress relief, like, oh, thank goodness. Things are terrible, but at least that wasn't actually real. It's so powerful. And maybe it's powerful because we don't look at it straight on. We don't think about it too hard. But it is exciting when we think about resistance and when we think about ways that the very weak can take on the very strong.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you come to deal with resistance even more in the third section. Can you tell us a little bit about the overarching theme of the third section of the book?
The last part of the book really focuses on the ways expressive culture can dismantle or subvert or prevent or hinder institutions. So can refuse to do the work that is expected by the Department of Corrections. And so when a person is in an occupation, of course, they spend most of their time working toward the goals of that occupation. But then most people, I think, also spend a significant amount of time undermining and fighting back and trying to carve out space that is separate from this is what I do for a living, or I am in alignment with the goals of this company, or whatever the situation might be. So the third part of the book really looks at not only how correctional humor undermines the correctional system or can refuse or resist the correctional system, but then also how it can refuse and resist sort of normative ideas about what a family is, what it is to be gay or what it is to be straight, and the ways that when you have to be a face for normativity, you can refuse that face, at least temporarily, using humor.
So could you maybe give us one or two examples of some stories that you were told that really stood out for you from this section?
I think the thing that I thought a lot about was the son of the people I might consider to be my godparents and his initial experiences working as a correctional officer and talking about the things that his friends said to him when he went to work in a prison and saying like, oh, you're going to go watch a bunch of dudes having sex, and then needing to say like, yes, I am. Yep. I am really, really excited about it. It's going to be great. Like having to then, you know, for a straight white kid in his 20s to say like, I am so interested in gay sex. Yep. I am a lot. So to take that joke, like, oh, you must be gay if you like watching men have sex, and then saying, yes, I am, is really, it undermines the sort of low-level, base-level homophobia that is pretty standard and refuses to be categorized as a homophobe, even though the sincerity is not there, and even though he's not going to go watch men have sex. He's still refusing this very boring, very stereotypical idea about prison.
Yeah, that's a great example. And that's in the first part of this final section, a chapter called Upholding and Undermining Social Institutions, Gay Jokes and Christmas in Prison. What jokes come out of Christmas in prison?
Well, I think there are many, many jokes about Santa Claus and child molestation. This gets referenced in the 45 signs you're a correctional officer. And there's a lot of jokes about Chester Claus and this the figure of Chester the molester. And so there's a lot of commentary, I think, among both officers and inmates about Santa Claus and this undermining of Santa Claus, who is good and true and beautiful, and making him into a scary, problematic figure. But at the same time, you know, I think about a story that another collaborator told me about men at a medium security prison, like putting on their own Christmas pageant and wanting to have pictures of the guards shaking Santa down and see the guards humiliate poor Santa Claus. I think there's a lot of refusal of the dominant narrative of Christmas because it's unbearable, I think, to embrace it in a sincere way when you're in prison. So I think refusing Christmas is a powerful way of refusing an institution that tells stories that don't feel true.
Right, right. Then in the next chapter, you're looking at how the workers in these institutions can play the fool or enact acts of resistance through humor. One I particularly liked was a worker who was criticized and asked to rewrite a report that was not long enough, and because basically nothing very much had happened to report on. So this is on page 186. He starts to push back and he says, He's now rewriting this report with the more detail that he's been asked to provide. And he starts out, the temperature was 72 degrees. The barometric pressure was falling, resulting in a cold front coming in from the west. And in fact, the report went on to be so kind of like outrageously detailed and kind of out there that he was... this particular worker was sent off for evaluation, I think.
Yeah, he spent a significant time off work because of this report, which, you know, sort of blended in some Apocalypse Now sort of stream of consciousness, trauma, flashback situation. And it was a joke report, but the joke was taken very seriously. And And so he was off all summer long. And, you know, everyone understood it was a joke. And yet the institution had the power to say, like, we're going to take this seriously. We see your humor and we raise you sincerity. And you are now on leave. It was, I think that, you know, the administration recognized that a joke had been attempted, and to say, we see what you're doing. We see that you're calling these rules arbitrary, and we see that you're questioning our authority, and we will now impose our authority on you. We do not accept your joke. It was a pretty firm response.
Right. It's actually very interesting the parallel that provides with the inmate officer humor that you discuss earlier in the book, where there's humor that can go on between the inmates and the officers, but it's a very fine line that they have to walk. And again, this has happened. We see this now happening between the officers and the broader institution.
Yeah, there's a big divide between officers and management. And quite often officers say, oh, management sees us as inmates. They see us as just the same as inmates. We are no better, and we are expendable. And so it's very difficult for a joking relationship to exist in unequal power structures. And so for a joke to be received as a joke means that hierarchy has to be temporarily suspended quite often. And it's very dangerous for a prison administration to suspend hierarchy, even for a little while. That is not to say it doesn't happen. And I think that low-ranking officers do quite often poke fun at administration and mess with them in very small ways to see how far this boundary can be pushed.
Then we come to the last chapter of your book. Can you tell us what this is? Because I think here you're moving away from how humor is used and making, and it's not a particularly humorous chapter.
Yeah, this chapter focuses on the stereotype of the prison guard. And I use that term because that's how it's most commonly used in movies and television. And the issues of social class. And so a lot of the kinds of humor that we see prison workers using, you can find parallels in more prestigious, more respected occupations such as doctor humor. And yet this humor is acceptable coming from a doctor, or at least a doctor on television, but is seen as pathological, violent, sadistic coming from a prison worker or a prison worker on television. And I think ultimately, you know, my argument is that when we cast the individual prison worker as the bad guy who is the person keeping this world racially unjust, is a very convenient deflection, because the prison worker individually has very little control over the social institutions that perpetuate racial inequality in the United States. So I think that prison guards become a really convenient scapegoat that are very, very easy to hate. And certainly there have been many terrible prison guards who have done terrible things. But they are individuals, and what we have is a system that produces these inequalities.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a very salient point. We've taken up an awful lot of time of yours, Claire. Is there anything that you wanted to say about the book or about anything else that I didn't give you the chance to say already?
I think the one thing that we didn't talk about, and the book doesn't talk about, but I think is going to increasingly become important, is the role that the internet plays in communicating occupational culture. I'm not going to, but is already and has for many, many years. And I think that it's a really exciting area that I've just barely explored. And I think that some of the most interesting examples of sort of a shared identity or identity that sort of bleeds into other family members, and the ways that sort of tangential tangentially affiliated people embody the identity and a stigmatized identity, whether that's of a police officer or a correctional officer, is played out on the internet. So I think that's a fascinating thing that into the future, I hope that Folklorists will address.
Oh, well, that brings me to my last question, which in tradition of these podcasts is, what are you working on now? Does it relate to internet occupational culture, or are you doing something else, or have you no time to do something else because you're teaching lots of classes?
I'm working on, what will probably become an article on sort of the use of memes online and GIFs among particularly the families of people who work in prisons, not necessarily the way they're used by people who work in prisons. And I'm working slowly, desultorily, but somewhat steadily on a book project looking at the role of that food plays in racism. And so focusing on food-related stereotypes and ways that we convey ideas about
which
race,
has made me remember that food. I have forgotten to ask you another question that I meant to ask you just before we reached the end of this interview, which is, I know you were having, you sent your interlocutors multiple drafts of your work and you had this process of consultation with them about what you were writing. How do they feel about this book?
That's a great question, and one that I'm not sure if I want to know the answer to. There were many, many times when I think that the things that I had written, whether in carelessness or in ignorance, were hurtful to the people I was writing about. I think that the process turned up a lot of misinformation, it brought to the forefront a lot of issues that are really difficult for people to discuss. But I think that the hardest thing was having to be in print. And certainly I use pseudonyms and I have done everything that I can to protect confidentiality. But everyone knows who everyone else is because they are all connected in a social web. And I think that the way my uncle talked about it was, it was really difficult to read the book. But it was okay that it was difficult, and it made him think about things a lot, and he was glad for that opportunity. That's a very kind way of saying, like, this was a very painful experience for me. So I have zero plans to do another project like this, because I'm glad I wrote this book. I'm glad I did the research. I felt someone should write about this, and I wanted to be the person to do it because I wanted to do it in a way that I could live with. But sharing your work and writing about living people with whom you are, in a social ongoing situation is very difficult.
Well, that's an excellent thinking point on which we can end our discussion. So Claire Schmidt, thank you so much for participating in New Books in Folklore.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.